Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. So today I'm joined by James Dama in person here in Austin. This is going to be my first in-person interview. I've been fascinated with this concept of just what's the difference between like a video call versus an in-person interview. We've got a lot of fun stuff to talk about: Tesla AI, full self-driving, Andre Karpathy's sabbatical, humanoid robot, the Tesla stock split. So James, I want to welcome you.
Great to be back.
Good seeing you in person.
Always, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely a different dynamic for sure.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting.
Yeah. So we're in Austin. What brings you to Austin? I'm curious.
Oh, I have family in Austin. So I actually was, I had already planned a trip out here before they announced the GigaFest. And so I extended it slightly so that I could be here when hopefully I'll be able to get a ticket at some point. So.
Yeah, seriously, I haven't gotten a ticket either. But yeah, looking forward to it if I get in. So big news though this week is Tesla stock split. Does it matter to you at all, or is this like
it's amusing to watch the market? I mean, I was having a conversation with somebody about this the other day, and like on the long term, you know, it doesn't matter, right? The shares are fungible, and Tesla's got some internal reasons for wanting to have more shares, like, you know, employee stock option type stuff is what you want to. You know, if the granularity gets too large on the options, then they lose their flexibility with applying that. But it does kind of signal, you know, all the things being equal, that, you know, if they're doing a split, they're more concerned with like having the stock price be too high than be too low in the future. It definitely signals that.
That's true.
Like if they have a concern about it being too low, you don't do a split. I mean, you might do a reverse split, right? If you have a concern with it being too high, then you do a split. And on balance between those two, obviously, you know, it's a confidence measure to say, well, we feel like it's a good idea to split the stock.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting because if Elon and the board thought the stock price was too high, then they wouldn't want to split.
Yeah, wouldn't split. You might reverse because if it gets too low, you have delisting issues, right? Yeah. I mean, at $1,000, you know, that's not going to happen anytime soon. But.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, the stock price is kind of crazy. It just like jumped like crazy.
That's but, you know, world, you know, between the pandemic and what's going on in Ukraine and, you know, this whole, like, when is the Fed going to tighten because we have this systemic shock with, that inflation is going on is, you know, unsurprisingly. And Tesla's a really high beta stock, right? Like, it moves it. I think, well, it's a beta is like 5 or something. It's crazy high. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was thinking this morning, I woke up and I'm like, maybe it was last night, but I was thinking, like, Tesla investors who got in before, let's say, 2019 or something or around then, and they've experienced this jump. They kind of, I wouldn't say got lucky, but a lot of people back then were thinking that full self-driving would be the driver of the stock price. But this appreciation has happened, this 20x or more, it hasn't been because of full self-driving largely, you know, it hasn't even arrived yet we have this appreciation, you know? And so it's kind of like this, it's like this great, interesting situation where people thought FSD or Robotaxi would you know, boost the stock price, but it was actually Tesla's earnings and its profitability, but we still have FSD or Robotaxi to come, right, for the next possible leg up. So it's kind of like this, I don't know, I think early Tesla investors are just like, I wouldn't say lucky, but yeah, I would say kind of lucky in some ways.
Yeah, maybe. The market has really lagged, you know, the market response to because Tesla has executed, you know, you plot Tesla's performance over time financially or via the number of vehicles they make. It's been pretty consistent. There haven't been these events where suddenly, you know, we got some big changes. I mean, obviously the Model 3 coming on, having a higher volume car and going to more, you know, if you step back and you look at it, you know, over time, it's a pretty smooth scaling. And, you know, James Stevenson does those plots. And you look at like vehicle production or you know, revenue or whatever, and it's an amazingly smooth curve. So there really haven't been surprises. The way Wall Street like looks, they're backward looking. They look at what has happened and they try to extrapolate forward. There hasn't been a good reason for Wall Street to really get excited, except for changes in the story, right? So that whole window of time, like up to 2019, like why was it lagging so badly? I mean, the reason we got that big step up at the end of 2019 was kind of like Wall Street's expectations catching up to reality, I would argue. Uh-huh. And so, I mean, I think the psychology of that five-year window when nothing happened, even though the company was really executing, you know, for long-term investors, mm-hmm. was, oh, it's never going to happen. What, I'm missing something. There's something wrong, you know. What? And the reality was just that Wall Street wasn't catching up. And then they caught up. And now, I mean, an interesting question to have after that transition was, well, is this a new kind of sort of psychology of Wall Street with respect to Tesla? Like, are they going to stay on the ball? Or are we going to have another one of these things where there's this, you know, the expectations have been reset and now they're going to wait five more years and they're just going to let the, you know, that seemed unlikely because there's too much attention on it now. Like, it's in the S&P. Mm-hmm. Like, it's such a big chunk of the stock market. It's such a big chunk of the options market. There's so much attention focused on it. And even though we still have, you know, the FUD out there, you know, you've got the counter arguments. Those voices have been greatly diminished. And I think the perception of risk has fallen off and people are willing to accept that, you know, it's executing well.
Yeah.
Like, even if there's no Tesla bot, even if there's no FSD, even if there's no, you know, even if solar doesn't take off and energy doesn't take off, like, it's a solid business. Like, you can just take the stuff they're executing on really well and you can make an investment thesis, which in my opinion, justifies where it's at right now and will continue to justify sort of improvements from here. And you know, so now the question is, which of these free call options is the one that's gonna you know kind of pay off?
I look at the stock price as up until Model 3 ramp was realized, that was just covering Tesla's operating expenses with the profit. But Model Y was additive, like because the core operating expenses are covered with Model 3 and Model S and X. Everything after that, it's like you might add a little bit to operating expenses, but most of it goes to the bottom line. And that's what people didn't expect. And that's what Wall Street didn't like really expect it to be so profitable, the business model. And so now I think it's like every quarter they're realizing, oh my gosh, it's like Tesla really has like you know, mid-teens. It's going to be pretty soon high teens operating margin. Once it gets up to possibly over 20%, they're just going to flip out.
At least, you know, the analysts who really pay a lot of attention to Tesla, you can tell the narrative is shifting on that kind of thing too. They're starting to, they're talking more about, you know, Rob over at Tesla Daily, he likes to talk about the operating leverage that Tesla has, which is just, it's crazy, the operating leverage that they have. And, you know, even people who just look at the numbers and just look backwards, they see that. And and if you extrapolate operating leverage forward from now, you get crazy numbers just, you know, without Tesla Robot, without FSD, without, you know.
And, even if, you know, Robotaxi doesn't come to fruition in the next few years, you still have that added FSD revenue. As it gets better, it's most likely take rate's going to increase, add to margins. It just helps the business overall, even without having a full robotaxi network. So, yeah, it's interesting. So the big news the past a couple days ago was Andre Karpathy, so Tesla's head of AI, and it's kind of a little bit, I want to say strange, but it just came up on Twitter, you know, that Andre is on a sabbatical, and it's about a 4-month sabbatical. And opinion is split on this amongst people. So some people are a little bit more hopeful, optimistic that, you know, it's just a sabbatical, things are going well enough for him to, you know, take a sabbatical, he'll be back, et cetera. And then there's another side of people who are like, oh my gosh, it's like, it's over. Andre is about to leave Tesla. This is just, you know, the transition for him out. So what's your take? I'm curious. Well, actually, to preface this, this is just speculation. We're just, and I don't think it's per se important for us to be accurate, or the guessing is, I guess what I'm trying to get is more, I want to look into more like, what do you think is Andre's key role at Tesla? And let's say hypothetically, like, how hard is it to replace him? Like, what uniquely does he bring to Tesla? And in the event where, let's say he does move on, whether it's this year, next year, or in 10 or 20 years, like, you know, eventually everyone moves on, you know? But just in the case he does move on sooner than people expect, like, is that a risk to Tesla's FSD program, the development? Or can someone come in, you think, you know, and provide similar leadership. But yeah, what's your take on this whole, you know, Carpathy sabbatical?
Yeah, so sometimes a cigar is a cigar, right? In fact, most of the times a cigar is just a cigar. And Freud had that comment about, so the sometimes things are just what they appear to be, right? Mm-hmm. And it's so little information leaks out of Tesla, and the world, the outside world, especially the Tesla community, is so rabid to cling on to things and try to read into stuff. And, you know, most of the time things are just what they are, you know. Yeah. The guy's been working, you know, at a startup basically for 5 years. He needs a break, man. You know, I mean, if this is the first long break he's taken since he started there, I'm actually kind of impressed with his fortitude. So, you know, sabbaticals are super common. I mean, they're mostly in academia kinds of settings. I can imagine, you know, looking at Andre's history, that he, I mean, it's like I quit my job because deep learning was moving so fast, right? He's like, I had been kind of working half-time at a job and sort of following machine learning related stuff before. And when deep learning took off, it was just like, I didn't even have time for a job anymore. Like, I couldn't keep up. So I imagine like how painful it is for Andre. Like, he's got all these duties that he's got to do every day. And there's all this amazing stuff happening all the time that he doesn't have time to talk to people about. He doesn't have time to think about it. He doesn't have time to play with it, try to understand the implications. Like, that's got to be difficult. And so taking a break to catch up, to sharpen up on this kind of stuff. Like, I mean, when he comes back to Tesla, it's good for Tesla, you know, because he's got all these new ideas and he's refreshed and he's strengthened his connection to the outside world for pulling ideas. And like, that's a good thing. And, you know, it's not uncommon at all. I mean, people in the tech industry do it. Like, and it's hard to do it in startups because everybody's working so hard all the time, right? And so on a flip side of this, when I look at it as like, I guess things are going okay, you know, because when you're really under the gun and things aren't going very well and you're worried, you've got to come up with problem, you know, you've got problems that have got to be solved because they're existential for the company or the product or the division that you work in. Nobody takes vacations, right? So like, to me, it's a bullish sign that he's taking time off, and I totally expect him to come back. Mm-hmm. Now, the second part of the question, like, does it matter if he comes back? Look, Andre's a super popular guy. So he's a draw. He's a super smart guy. He's got a lot of unique capabilities. So it's great for Tesla to have him on board. There's probably no trick that Andre is capable of doing that there aren't lots of other people that can do, whether they can do it as well as he can. Like, maybe you need two or three other people to replace what he does. Mm-hmm. You know, my understanding of his role is he's leadership in the AI group, and he mostly thinks about how to build and tune and train neural networks, probably emphasis on the training part of it. Mm-hmm. Like, my own observation of the stuff he writes about and talks about and gets excited about is that his skills are like, the unique things that he has are the ability to digest a new technique that he sees in a paper, reproduce it himself, and explore it to sort of understand what the potential is. So that's a pretty useful role. Like, Tesla, their neural network stuff has kind of evolved over time. It started out where, you know, they started with some straightforward, pretty well understood techniques, and they just tried to build on those to understand what was going on with them. And then we saw over time that they added more bells and whistles, and then, you know, the network got more complicated. And and probably there's all kinds of stuff that we don't see, which Andre's talked about a couple of times in the past, about how they adapted their training techniques for the neural networks. You know, and they probably have more innovations in training than they do in network architecture. But, you know, so Andre's, I think, got a lot of strength in being able to quickly evaluate a new possibility at small scale to understand if this is something they should put more effort into. And then I suspect equally, although it's harder to see this outside of Tesla, that when they get up to scale, he's probably pretty good at helping debug, you know, like, what's a better way to tweak this part of the training process, right, to do that. So I think he's probably very highly productive, but I don't think that there's any sort of magic stuff that he's got that other people can't do. And he's one guy in what's become a big organization. Like, he's a very small part of the overall Autopilot effort. He's a bigger part probably of the AI effort that they're doing. But even so, he's going to be one of, you know, they've probably got, you know, I would guess like 50 or 100 really good data scientists, you know, working on that team. And Andre's good. Yeah. Right. But he's not so good that, you know, he's going to, you know, the team is going to be crippled if he moves on.
Yeah.
I think he'll stay. I think if he doesn't, if he decides to go, because, you know, it's an amazing opportunity to be able to do what he does at Tesla. But it's also very, very narrow compared to the breadth of Andre's interests. Mm. Like, he's super interested in language models, too, and you're not going to be doing a lot of that at Tesla, right? And, you know, the more mature a system gets that you build, the more and more you need to focus on making that system better. And the less you think about, how would I do it if I started over from scratch today? And I think Andre really likes that part. So I would also say that his best contributions are in much earlier stages, and that the more technical debt Tesla develops, because, you know, they've got a big system, they're already pretty committed to the way that they're doing stuff and whatnot, the less of a difference, and not that he's not useful, right? But the less difference, the less critical having somebody with what I understand Andre's talents to be, is matters less. So anyway, net, I think, is bullish.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm curious, how can you make sense of Andre's role? So we know he's head of AI, and we know, you know, Autopilot is separate. I would imagine there's a lot of overlap at different points, maybe. I mean, let's say Andre, you know, he's setting up the neural nets, training the neural nets, but then training these neural nets, like, is he in charge of labeling? Is he in charge of data gathering? Is he in charge of, you know, other, like, how about simulation? You know, that's part of training too. Is he doing all of that, or is he just more isolated, you think, on the neural nets? Like, and it just seems like there's overlap, you know, between so-called AI or neural nets and, you know, the practical benefit to Autopilot. So where do you think his responsibility kind of cuts off?
I mean, so my guess is he probably doesn't have production responsibility. So, you know, in big software and data center systems and whatnot, there's the part of the system that's actually servicing customers today. Mm-hmm. And if it's a big complicated system, and Autopilot has certainly become that, you have to be very careful about the changes that you do. So when you consider making changes to that system, you kind of stage them. Like, you have a group over here that develops a new thing, checks it out, tries to understand the implications for, you know, what it means for the production system. And then you put together a plan for how you're going to slide it into production so that you get the benefits without disrupting production, so that, you know, the services that the customer relies on sort of continue. I think it's extremely likely that Andre's got very limited input or very limited responsibilities on the production side. So labeling is on the production side. The team that develops new stuff that you want to push into production, they have to have access to and understand all the different aspects of the production system. They might need to inject, you know, they will frequently be called in to help fix problems in production, right? Because you've got this expertise here, these people who are looking at stuff, especially when you slide something new in. You know, the production team needs to understand the implications of these new things that are coming in. So there's a lot of communication back and forth between these two groups. But the, you know, the reporting stack, like what you're specifically responsible for, like, my impression is Andre's very much responsible for the much smaller part of the team that essentially figures out, what does the data engine need to be doing, and helps build the infrastructure for the data engine, right? And over in production, that's the data engine itself. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, there's actually another level of production, which is like the guys who run the data center and push the updates out to the cars and deal with, you know, it's kind of on the ground stuff. The data engine itself, the data engine is production to Andre, right? So like on Andre's side of the thing, you know, they're figuring out, you know, how to go about modifying the data engine to get a better neural, to get a better system. But the data engine itself is upstream of the production that actually pushes stuff out. So he's a couple of steps removed from the stuff that actually ends up on cars, I think. And he's probably working on a relatively small team that's heavily data scientists and people who, you know, they sort of have a very deep understanding of what the stuff is doing at a theoretical level. And they probably spend a lot of time sort of trying to diagnose and understand how the data engine is actually working in the real world and how it's got to change. But the data engine itself, you know, Operation Vacation, right? The data engine itself is designed so you can take all the data scientists and you stop using them, and the data engine will continue to improve. Like, its structure won't change, but, you know, new incremental features will continue to be rolled in. You know, the team on that side understands, you know, how to bring in a new feature, how to collect a data set for it, how to refine it, how to, you know, test it to verify it's good enough to push out to cars, and then how to move it over to the part of production that actually services the vehicles in the field. The data scientists, they need to be able to get set to separate themselves from all that stuff, because they've frequently got to go offline and think about something that's discontinuously different. Like, every time there's a big structural change to the underlying neural network that's going to go out to the car, they have to do a certain amount of, like, starting over, right? Or they have to build a whole the system, figure out, like, what's the data that needs to go into training this system, what's the best way to collect it, what does it need to be good at, what matters less, what results are we going to get, how do we evaluate all that kind of stuff, right? So, so I think he's probably, you know, a significant part, you know, he's a significant data scientist in the group that's doing the AI part. And of course, when you're doing TeslaBot, you know, the data scientists, in a sense, the same data science group, you know, can move right over. But, you know, the data engine, well, you'd have a data engine for TeslaBot that would be similar to the data engine, but it wouldn't be the same data engine. You wouldn't run TeslaBot off the same data engine. And of course, the production is completely different, right? Because literally the code that you push out to the robot and the code that goes out to the car are going to be two different things. And the people who build, you know, there'll be people who build, you know, like the server infrastructure and the you know, the supercomputer in the back. And then, like, all those things can be shared between the two efforts. But the, you know, that intermediate level is likely to be quite distinct for each, you know, categorically different product that you have. But the data scientists, they can work on both of these things.
Yeah, yeah. I think, my take is generally, like, I'm optimistic on it, because I think there are times when a person who is in charge of the problem of a program or department leaves because things aren't going well, things are moving too mm-hmm. slow, they have a better offer, or there's different factors. But in this situation, it doesn't seem like it's because Andre isn't happy with the progress, or there's something fundamentally wrong with the program. It seems like more of a personal kind of how much he can handle, wanting to step back a bit to explore, to take a break. It does. I do agree, though, with some of the people, like, let's say Gary Black, who's a little bit skeptical of this stuff, where it's crunch time. It's like FSD. It's like Elon.
It's not crunch time.
Yeah, it's not
crunch time. That's just wrong.
Or I don't say crunch time, but for Elon, he wants to push this out by the end of the year, right? He's like, he's extremely motivated to get FSD working, you know, on a higher or a safer level. And Elon is trying to probably push his team even faster than before, pushing them just like he's just, this is one of the things that's taking up most of his, you know, attention right now. I wonder if that pressure, not just the pressure himself, but maybe it seeps into certain decisions, or certain, like, Elon gets more hands-on and it maybe increases the pressure to a certain point where, I don't know, perhaps something, I don't say happened, but maybe, like, you know, Andre's like, wait a minute, like, this is like way beyond my stress level or that I'm comfortable dealing with at this time. And it's just, maybe, I don't know what's going on personally with him, but to take a 4-month sabbatical at this juncture of, like, from Elon's point of view, like, a critical point of time, it seems a pretty bold decision. And I think Elon might have just, you know, like, unless, like, Elon, I don't think he understands that completely, because he doesn't take sabbaticals like that, you know? But he probably was accommodating for Andre because he respects Andre, and he feels, you know, Andre plays such an important role at Tesla. So Elon's probably like, I don't like the idea, you know, of you taking a sabbatical, but I have no choice, you know, fine, take it. But I don't know. That's the question mark. I would say 80%, I'm like optimistic about this whole thing. I think he comes back because Tesla bot is too alluring. FSD, it's like, this is one of the most exciting places for him to be. He's built up his team. He has everything, and he's expressed, you know, hope to come back. So 80%, 90%, you know, he's back. But I do have a little bit question mark just in terms of the length of sabbatical. Why doesn't he take 2 to 3 weeks, you know, or a month? You know,
sabbaticals are normally like a year.
Yeah, or a vacation, right?
Sabbaticals are in academia or a year. Like 4 months is a short sabbatical. It's not a long sabbatical.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm just saying, like, I guess that's where the tension exists also, where Elon doesn't operate on this academic sabbatical, you know, timeline frame.
It's that you're reading a lot into a very small amount of external information. Yeah. I mean, like I don't see anything in what Elon's, like, his recent demeanor that suggests that FSD is in crisis, right?
Yeah.
When one of Elon's things is in crisis and he spends all his time thinking about it, like, that's what his tweets are about. That's what's on the top of his mind, right? Unless he's specifically trying to limit himself. Like, I don't see anything in the nature of his tweets about FSD that suggests that FSD is in crisis.
Yeah.
I'd argue the opposite. I'd say things are moving. The other thing, the data science group, you know, they work on a system up front, and then it goes to the data engine, and then the data engine cranks on it for a really long time to refine it. And as it's getting refined, it kind of moves across the wall. So, you know, Andre might be going on sabbatical because they hit a major milestone. Okay. And we're not going to see it for a while because it's got to work through, like, you know, we haven't seen the unified stack. There's a bunch of features that we know are coming that Tesla has talked about, that Elon has talked about, that we haven't seen manifest yet. So the data science group, they have a role in creating that stuff and getting the basic structure together so that you're confident that the data engine can do it. But then you kick it over the wall and the data engine cranks on it, maybe for 3 months, maybe for 6 months before it's, you know, refined and optimized. And normally in that window, the data science group, they go and they work on whatever the next stage is. So, you know, if Andre's taking a break, I mean, like, I don't have any super insight into the details of what's going on inside there. I just personally, I don't see any signs that the FSD is in crisis. My sense is it's moving.
Yeah.
Well, if there's a crisis, like, to the extent that there's something going wrong, it's just taken longer. It's taken more data.
Yeah.
You know, they're getting another, you know, thing that they have to deal with is, like, as the crew of people using it gets bigger and bigger and bigger in the real world, they have to get more and more and more careful about what they push out the door. They have to do more QA. They have to do more stages of QA. You push it out to, you know, 10 people use it, and then 100 people use it, and then 1,000 people use it, and then 10,000 people use it. And you need a certain amount of evaluation and adjustment in between those. So, you know, when you got 1,000,000 people using it in the field, then you got to go 10,000, 100, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's like 10 steps now to get to where it goes out the door. So, and you do that because it is a safety critical system, right? And you are dumping it on people with no training. I mean, training in the sense that a lot of these people have experience using it. But, you know, the system ostensibly is something you just give your dad, and he just gets in the car and he says, take me to the grocery store, and he just goes, right? He could be any guy. He could be, you know, of any demeanor, of any, you know, his car might be old, it might be snowing. I mean, you've just got this, you know, you have to work and so the amount of care you have to take for each successive one before it goes out the door. And all of this is a big drag on how fast you can iterate new features and get them out the door. So, like, it's not difficult for me to imagine that part of the equation of getting FSD, keeping it moving forward as it gets bigger and bigger, you know, like the organization gets bigger, there's more inertia to everything that you do, and you're trying to make it move fast, but still it's going to slow down.
Yeah.
So, like, it's super unsurprising to me that it's taken longer than they thought it would, that it would take. And I would say it's probably going to keep on taking longer than they, but, you know, because you have to get really lucky for there to be a sudden, you know, you had this super hard problem and boom, you had a solution in it. And, like, now you're ahead of schedule. Like, that's less common than, oh, now we have this other problem that we just discovered and now you're slower.
Yeah.
I'm super sanguine about all of this kind of stuff. The other thing, you know, Elon's made comments about what he expected to have happen this year. And my read on those comments is a lot different than I see Twitter taking them, right? You know, my recollection is he said, you know, I'd be shocked if we, if the system isn't safer than a human this year, right? Like, that doesn't mean to me that I, you know, that he expects to be shipping a product in volume to North America where people can sleep in the backseat, right? That they're, or even that he expects to cross a threshold where he's convinced regulators of anything, right? It's a, to me, it's a technical milestone. Like, if their internal data on interventions that they see, the severity of interventions, the frequency of interventions, and the kinds of interventions that they, that they have, if they look at that data internally and say, yeah, it's a, you know, it's our statistics say that for the regime that people are using, because remember, people, you don't drive this out of your driveway today, and you don't use it in parking lots, really. You know, FSD, when it was AP, the regime was like on-ramp to off-ramp kind of, or highways. Mm. And FSD expands the domain that it operates over to a certain subset of street driving, and not 100%, because it still doesn't park itself, right? There's a lot of important critical features robotaxis need that they haven't done yet. They've expanded the domain. If they say inside our operating domain, the domain for which we have designed this thing, it is, you know, 10x less likely or 2x less likely than a human being to have an accident. Like, to me, that's Elon being right. Like, they, you know, the infrastructure they built for the thing that they're doing right now is that. That's very different from robotaxi shipping in volume. It's very different from people being able to sleep in the back of their car. Mm-hmm. It, you know, that might not even be them getting 100% of FSD revenue for the stuff that they push out, because maybe, you know, it's not feature complete. It's, there's a, there are a bunch of little things that they have to add to it before it's ready to go out as a robotaxi. Mm-hmm. So I think Elon can be right, and they can be making good progress, and they can, and they can achieve all of the goals, even the optimistic goals that he's had, and they still don't have robotaxis this year.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree. I think, to clarify, I'm not saying like FSD is in crisis at all, mm-hmm. because I think progress is actually moving very fast. I think there's a possibility there could be a perceived crisis, or in Elon's mind, in terms of timeline. Like, he's trying to push things so fast. Yeah. That even though it's like moving really fast, in his mind, it's not moving fast enough. Like, he's like, everyone else is like, oh, things are going great. But for Elon, he's like, you know, like,
you're fired. Yeah, it's like, he's like, we're restructuring the program.
He's on a different, like, his mind works differently, I think, in that sense. I mean,
but the things he wants to do before he dies, which, like, normally we think they're going to take 300 years. So, yeah, he's in a hurry.
Yeah. So, but I mean, that's, to me, that's like part of the unique thing that Elon brings, is this urgency where he's really trying to push things, you know, as fast as they can. And I think a lot of times when teams get bigger, companies get bigger, there's so much, not just bureaucracy, but relationships where you don't want to fire people. Like, typically, managers, they want to get along with people, right? But for Elon, it's about like how fast things are moving, and he's not afraid to let go of people if he thinks it's going to increase, you know, the pace. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think most people, that's a very difficult decision. They'd rather lower or not reach the most optimal pace if they could keep everyone happy and their friends, because they've built relationships with their coworkers and their teams and all this stuff. But yeah, it's like it's an interesting dynamic that I think, I haven't heard many people talk about it, but it just seems like that type of mentality has potential to drive things very fast, you know, if you,
and to drive people away and to make a super stressful work environment. It's the two sides of the coin.
Exactly. Nothing's just it's not the most perfect thing on all levels, you know, in terms of, but it's in terms of the quickest pace, it possibly, you know, could lean on that angle. Okay, moving on. So a bunch of interesting things. I don't know if you've watched the Sandy Monroe's latest take. It was about a week ago on E for Electric. He said that he thinks that Tesla's FSD hardware or their cameras are not sufficient, in his opinion. He thinks, you need to do the forward-looking infrared kind of cameras. Like, and he thinks that is the holy grail to full self-driving. Several people on Twitter were saying, hey, can James mm-hmm. kind of give his thoughts on that? What's your take?
So there's this persistent sort of perception that machines driving cars are worse than people with the same sensors, and that they're always going to be worse than people, and that we have to supplement them with better sensors somehow, that the sensors are going to be critical to getting there because the brains aren't going to get there. And I disagree with that sort of assumption, this unstated assumption, which is baked into these things. I mean, the brains in the cars are going to get where they're much better than human beings at doing this stuff. You know, for a long time, you know, people thought, you know, computers are never going to be better than humans at chess or better than humans at Go, just to pick a couple of examples. And now it's like, it's absurd to say, oh, I'm going to beat my computer at chess. Like you could be Garry Kasparov and your iPhone can beat you at chess. You're never going to beat your iPhone, right? Because it takes a while to get there, to get this stuff there. And the cars are going to get there too, where the car can be, you know, blinded in three cameras and it can be a snowstorm and you can have no idea and the car's still fine, right? They're just going to be, they are going to be superhuman in their capabilities. So, I think just the fact that it's got omnidirectional vision is a huge thing. It's a huge sensor advantage. Now, in an earlier conversation that we had about this, we talked about other sensors. I definitely think there are other sensors that you can add that would make the system better, right? If you cared to put them on. And I think I mentioned thermal infrared, FLIR, which is I haven't seen Sandy's show, but that's what I've seen in the comments is that he was talking about that. And I think, you know, that'd be a great idea. You know, there are all kinds of capabilities you add, but even without going to that, multispectral cameras, which was another thing that I mentioned. I mean, humans, we see the world in three colors and we build cameras that see the world in the same three colors, but that's just, you know, the world isn't three colors. It's a continuous set of spectral wavelengths. And, you know, we can and build cameras that have 10 colors instead of three colors. And we can build cameras that are polarization sensitive. They sense the polarization of the light. And if you added all of this additional information discriminatory factor to, you know, what the neural network was taking in, you know, all of those things would be helpful at understanding the world better. They would have disadvantages that they would be harder for humans to debug. Like, it's hard to look at a multispectral image and understand what's going on, you know. The biggest disadvantage they have in the short run is that they just cost a lot more. Like, there's a very small volume in multispectral cameras. Anyway, there's tons of sensors that you could add. Mm-hmm. Do you need to add them? I think no, you don't need to add them. Overwhelmingly, the way the system is lacking today is that the brains are not yet good enough. And that's a combination of a bunch of things. But the single most important thing is our techniques for building and training neural networks and gathering the data. Those are not yet sufficient. So of all the things sitting on the table that need to get better for the technology, that's the thing that needs to get better. And, you know, getting into other sensors, they could have benefits. But they're a distraction from, you know, in my opinion, they're a distraction from the core problem of, like, make the brains better. Like, that's where almost all the benefit is. You have to get better at all that stuff. So focus on that.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, do you foresee a day where, let's say 10 years from now, you know, cars are driving fantastic. Is there a need, you think, even at that point to add extra sensors? Like,
I can imagine all kinds of ways it would be useful to have other, like, you know, we put headlights on cars right now.
Yeah.
And so maybe, you know, when they're all robo-taxis out there, you're like, it'd be great if we could take the headlights off the cars. They cost money. No, 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 no. So you put, you know, thermal infrared on the car. You give it other ways to see in the dark. It's advantageous to see in the dark. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are lots of situations where it works. We build roads today so you don't need to. We put lights on cars, we put lights on roads, and we build roads so that they have clear open spaces and stuff. And it doesn't work perfectly. You still get the thing where you're like driving down a mountain road and a deer jumps in front of your car. Right. Like, that's a thing thermal infrared would really help with, because you could see the deer in the field. You know, you could see it coming. It wouldn't be a big surprise because it just jumped into your headlight beams.
Yeah.
So there are these corner cases that are problems today that adding extra sensors will fix, but they're not on the short list of problems that we want to deal with right now.
Yeah, makes sense.
And once again, I would go for, you know, I would go for active radar before anything. Like, of all the sensors that you could add that have a lot of potential, like having a very high resolution, and I think Elon has said more or less the same thing, right? Having a high resolution radar is potentially because it complements vision in ways that almost like multispectral cameras, they're kind of complementary to regular vision, but not nearly as much as radar is. Mm. Radar's got this penetrating characteristic that it has. It responds very differently to objects in the environment than optical light does. And it's an active sensor, right? It's an active sensor that doesn't bug people. If you put bright lights on your car, you know, you have to build your neighborhood so that headlights aren't shining in the, you know, the windows at night. But with radar, you know, we can, it's not perceptible to human beings. So you can have really high power radar and it doesn't bug anybody, but you can't put like one of the limiters on LIDAR on how long LIDAR can be is that the light that LIDAR puts out is dangerous to human eyes. Right. Mm. And so they have to limit the power and they have to, you know, they have to have all these constraints on how LIDAR can work because you can't be blinding people in the environment as you're driving around, and radar doesn't have any of those problems.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. I mean, so do you think, I mean, one option, it seems like Tesla could have gone with a better radar even, but then they pulled radar completely off. Do you think that's just so they can focus kind of on the cameras and the brain to get that right? And then after they solve it, then, you know, it seems like adding a sensor or two later on isn't as big as a problem because you've solved the main problem. You're just making it better, let's say 5-10 years down the road.
Once you get into diminishing returns, or, you know, you start to hit a maximum on what you can do. As, you know, as I said, there are some problems you just can't solve with vision. And people like to bring these up like fog or whatever. I mean, the right answer to fog is you stop driving just like a human being does, right? Mm-hmm. But maybe in the future, we don't want to stop driving, right? And we want the cars to be able to continue to function in that environment or in a sandstorm or you want to be able to deal with the deer jumping out of the bushes thing, right? Or see people walking at the side of the road in situations where, you know, just from headlights, they would be occluded. And right now, there are a lot of problems we solve by making the infrastructure better, making the roads wider, putting street lights on, you know, putting markings and that kind of stuff down. And there might be a point in the future where, you know, it just makes more sense to like make the cars more capable and not have to spend as much money on infrastructure. Like that's a trade-off that could happen.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a few people on Twitter, Harrison and G. Sidhu, asking about Comma. So Comma tweeted recently something about the odds of passing Tesla
this year have just gone
higher.
And Andre replied from 0.001% to.
Some people are like, are giving Comma more credibility or more credence. Like they're saying, oh, maybe there's a chance. But from your perspective, why is it, I guess, not very realistic? But I guess a bigger question is when you look at competitors and you hear people saying, oh my gosh, they're way ahead of Tesla or something, what gives you the confidence or do you have confidence that you're like Tesla is in the lead or is, I guess, in the lead? It's hard to say because you could say, oh, Waymo or Cruise or something is in the lead with LiDAR-based, you know, geofenced, you know, urban, whatever, type of taxis. But in terms of generalized vision-only system, is it the amount of data Tesla is collecting? Is it their kind of their full stack, kind of the complexity that of their neural nets and their training? Is it the amount of compute? Is it... what is it that's giving you the confidence, like compared to other camera-based approaches, that Tesla is kind of ahead and significantly ahead of others?
Yeah. So I don't really see, you know, the competition as like this line and everybody's on this line and they're, you know, I see the competition is sort of more multidimensional than that. I see Cruise and Waymo as solving a different problem than you know, they, you know, the robotaxi problem, you know, Waymo and Cruise, they look at this as like in a certain constraint, like robotaxis are these fleet operated vehicles, they're in cities, they have certain cost sensitivities, the things they compete with are human driven taxis. And these are the, you know, there's a certain set of characteristics the product needs to have. And they're trying to solve for that, right? Yeah. I see Tesla solving for a different problem. It's a little bit different. I mean, in a lot of ways, they overlap, obviously. They're both trying to make cars that drive themselves at some point. But And, you know, and Kama's trying to solve it a different way, right? And that's great. And Wave is trying to solve it a different way. And that's great, too. Like, I think it's great that people are taking different approaches to this. And they're envisioning different, not just a different approach, but they're envisioning different solutions to this problem that we have of, like, you know, the inefficiency and mayhem of, you know, 3,000-pound death machines rolling down the street with barely competent human beings behind the wheel. So comparing Tesla to Cruise and Waymo always feels kind of awkward to me. Mm. And I've also said in the past, and I still believe that this is true, that Tesla can succeed and Cruise can succeed and Waymo can succeed. Like, there is a point eventually, like, down when, as we, you know, look towards everything getting commoditized, where they must compete because they're going to be fighting over the same customers. But to a large extent, in the short run, they're not competing for the same customers, or they don't have to compete for the same customers because the demand is so much larger. Like, all of them could succeed, and it would still be a long time before you can satisfy demand to the point where they have to start poaching each other's customers. There's, like, plenty of potential to go around, right? And so depending on what time frame you're talking about, depending on what domain you're talking about, I can see, you know, Tesla's approach having advantages, or Tesla's robotaxi approach having advantages relative to, you know, what you can, what, you know, Cruise's approach and Waymo's approach and that kind of stuff. Certainly Cruise and Waymo, they're pulling forward in a certain sense, like trying to get to commercialization of cars that have no driver in them. Like, if the metric is, you know, how soon will you be driving 1,000 people around the country in car, you know, 1,000 people a day, you know, man, it's a Cruise and Waymo are going to get there. I mean, Waymo is probably already there, right? If that's the metric. If the metric is, you know, at what point, you know, do 1 million people a day use this thing? Yeah, then it might be more of a toss-up, right? Because there are more scaling issues with, if your platform itself is more expensive and complicated and requires more setup to operate, which is sort of the disadvantage that Cruise and Waymo have relative to Tesla's approach, assuming they all work. Then, you know, your ability to scale rapidly. So, you know, you could imagine Cruise and Waymo sort of scaling like this and Tesla coming from behind, but scaling faster and passing them. So how it looks in this zone before Tesla's passed them and how it looks after this zone is different. Yeah. There are also going to be domains like that, right? Like Cruise and Waymo, like the economics might not work out in, like, Des Moines where my dad lives, or rural Iowa or something like that. Whereas the economics for Tesla might be good enough that that's a place that, like, in the beginning, they start with that, because maybe, you know, 3 years from now when this stuff is all ramping up, you know, Cruise is doing great in San Francisco. And so that's a small market, or it's a relative competitive disadvantage maybe for Tesla, because maybe their corner cases aren't as well sorted out as Cruise's are in that situation, right? But, you know, if you get a Cruise car, you can't go to Nevada, right? But, you know, you get on the Tesla network and your car can take you to Las Vegas. I mean, there's going to be this sort of disparity in the capabilities of these systems for quite a while that's going to make them sort of complementary in a lot of respects and not strictly competitive because they're not head-to-head. So anyway, there's a business models that I don't believe perfectly compete head-to-head. It's fun to talk about it that way, and certainly people think about it that way, but I don't really see it that way myself. Mm-hmm. The technology is similarly, right? The stuff that Cruise has to solve well and the time frame they have to solve it in, you know, to be successful is different in many respects than the stuff that Tesla has to do. And Kama is another very interesting take on that. I got a lot of respect for Kama. I think George Hotz is a super interesting guy. I think he's a super smart guy. And I'm really impressed with what they've been able to do, given the resources that they have. Like kudos to him. I think the idea that they're going to pass Tesla this year is kind of comical, right? And it's not because there's no merit to the way that they do it. But, you know, when I think about, you know, what sort of technical advances it takes for Cruise to be able to do that, like, even if they had the silver bullet today, right? Like, the stuff that you have to do before you can, you know, like, crank it out into production and get it out there and test it and all that kind of stuff. Like, I don't even think you can do that in a year, right? So I have a really hard time imagining how they blow. And one of the metaphors I thought of is, like, what do you think are the odds that Rivian's going to pass Tesla this year? Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, even if their design was perfect, even if their production was perfect, and that kind of stuff, just scaling it to the point where they passed Tesla this year. And so, in a lot of ways, I feel like the Kama versus, you know, Tesla, Tesla's autopilot is kind of similar to the Rivian versus, you know, they started later. They have some advantages, but they got a number of disadvantages. And overcoming those in a really short window is just super unlikely. Now, if you were to ask, well, will Rivian pass Tesla in 10 years? Well, it gets more complicated then, right? Because lots of things can happen in 10 years. And if you ask me that about Comma, I might say the same thing, because like I can imagine technological advances in end to end that, I mean, I don't think they're likely. You know, they're quite unlikely, but they're not zero probability, where, you know, Calm is in a good position to take advantage of that with their efficiency and their business model and whatnot. And, you know, their addressable market is big. It's like all the cars on the road that have a certain set of, you know, and in a lot of ways they can scale pretty quickly. Like if they had the secret sauce and they got the recipe exactly right, you know, they're just building this consumer grade widget that you stick, you know, on in your car and it can drive. So like, you know, in a sense, that's kind of like they're doing to Tesla what Tesla does to Cruise and Waymo. They've got a much simpler, much more straightforward, easier manufacturer thing that can really, really scale fast. Mm-hmm. I just think that the odds that Comma gets that breakthrough and has the resources to really fully exploit it, in the short run, I just think but I'm glad somebody's pursuing it, because when you look at the amount of money that's going into Comma, like it's a bargain. The research and the work that they do for the investment the world is making in that, they're doing amazing stuff. Sure. But it's just it's a different scale. Like Tesla's effort is like literally 1,000 times larger.
Yeah. I think it's easy for people who are on the outside and don't understand the complexities of what's going on with a program like Tesla's FSD. It's like, you don't see the scale of the teams and all of the different things that need to come into place for something like FSD to happen, even an update and all this stuff. It like literally it's a monster of operation. And I don't know. So I was watching this. It reminds me, I was watching Ex Machina. Have you seen that movie at all?
I think so.
It's like about this a humanoid robot that is so Joe Rogan talked about this movie at a recent interview, saying it's one of his top 5 or top 10 movies. So I'm like, okay, I watched it like on double speed, because like I don't want to sit through 2 hours. But what struck me was I didn't think it was that great of a movie, but one of the things is the guy making the robot, it was like just himself, like in this island where he's like, you know, crafting stuff. And it's like this typical, I won't say typical, but it's like a Hollywood take on what it takes to make a humanoid robot. You just need one genius person, kind of like that.
And a great idea.
Exactly.
Right. It's all about the idea.
Yeah. Like Tony Stark, you know, making Iron Man suit or something. Yeah. You just need one person in his hideout making this, you know, amazing thing. It's like the genius.
There are things that happen that way, but complex products, you know, are not.
Exactly.
They don't. You can have great ideas. I mean, Edison had a great idea, but, you know, he didn't make all those light bulbs himself, right?
And it seems like with Tesla, I think it's easy to underestimate or not appreciate the complexity of, like Tesla is betting their company. I want to say betting their company, but a good chunk of their entire company is focused on this, you know, with their R&D and engineers. And it's a huge operation that...
I think probably so. I mean, we don't really know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you can look at the hiring listings and we can make guesses about stuff, and you can look at the R&D, but they don't break out the R&D. Elon made a comment one time about most of the R&D was autopilot. Like, I don't know if I believe it. Maybe that's true. I don't know how they allocate their R&D.
Yeah.
But even if all of their R&D is autopilot, man, you know, they're not spending a lot of money. So on the one hand, you could say, but then, you know, maybe the labelers don't count against R&D. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know enough about accounting to know what they have to put in that number and what they don't have to put in that number. But, you know, I'm definitely, my sense is this is not like 30 guys, you know, in a trailer someplace working this stuff out.
Yeah. Okay, so we have a bunch of questions on Twitter just regarding FSD. I'll read out a few of them. Agent of agency says, why can't Tesla nail down what appears to be very fundamental components of FSD, like speed sign recognition, perfected lane keep, left-hand turns, when they would have more than sufficient data to utilize? Is there some type of technical piece missing? Does it require more time? I'm not sure exactly what this question refers to, because
there's a whole lot of things I could imagine it refers to, like the speed sign thing. Like, that's a great example. Like, sometimes it seems like the car doesn't see a speed sign when you go by, and sometimes it doesn't see the speed sign when you go by. But so a human looking at this situation doesn't our perception of driving is almost all unconscious. So we don't know all the assumptions that are baked into, like, our understanding of a situation. When we see a speed sign, we right away know if it's in context for us or not, right? Like, does it apply to this road? And there's a lot of situations where that's actually pretty subtle. There are lots of situations where it's not. But the thing is, if you build a system that has to take the context into account before it considers whether to, you know, adopt what it's seeing on a speed sign, you can have rules where the rules don't work perfectly in some situations, and a speed sign that's perfectly in context to a human being, just the heuristics that were written by the programmer, there's something about the situation you're in that is messing up those heuristics. And so the heuristic is saying, yeah, that's a speed sign. I see it. I can read it. I'm going to ignore it because I have a set of rules for when I adopt a speed sign and when I don't. And they're telling me not to do that, right? There's still a lot of heuristics that are baked into the system in addition to the neural networks. And like, I used FSD to drive over here. I've been using it since I've been in Austin. And the Austin road system, it's a unique road system. I'm sure you've noticed since you're here. Actually, a lot of Texas, big Texas cities have a road system like this. But FSD messes up a lot on the things that are unusual about the Austin road system. And it messes up in situations that make no sense, right? Like, you're on a highway access road and you're going to merge onto a freeway. So in Austin, they have these 55 mile an hour access roads. And then they have these freeways that are like 75 mile an hour, 65 mile an hour speed. And the access roads run parallel. And all of the mergers are on and off the access roads. And then the access roads between in long stretches in between major intersections or whatnot, they'll have an on-ramp or an off-ramp where essentially you can move onto or off of it. And it's great for high-speed flow, right? So why is it when I'm moving 55 miles an hour down an access road that's a 55 mile an hour access road and I want to merge onto a highway that's got like a 65 or 70 mile an hour speed limit, and I'm merging on a dead straight, 200 foot long piece of concrete that my car wants to slow down to 35 miles an hour, right? Why, oh, why? And I'm sure people in Austin get really frustrated by this, right? But, the rules that are, they don't have a special set of rules for Austin. I mean, maybe they're adding more rules for Austin or whatnot. But, it's a freeway on-ramp, even though it's dead straight, right? In most places in the world, your freeway on-ramp is from a road that's got a 30 mile an hour speed limit, and the ramp has a speed limit. And then you're getting onto something that's a bit faster, right? So the idea that your ramp has a lower speed limit than either the road you're moving on or moving off, like, that's something I think the heuristics don't really take into account. And the ramp speeds are kind of allocated automatically. They have a satellite image, it looks at a piece of concrete, it decides, all other things being equal, when they calculate these, the metrics for the roads, they have a rule that looks at something, says, oh, that's a ramp and it should be this speed or whatever based on its geometry or whatever. And it's not perfect. So the fact that your car is going a weird speed, even though the speed limit sign, it seems to you to be super, super clear, is often because there are all of these rules kind of, because they still have a lot of heuristic code in there that's got to get it right. So this, one of the advantages of neural networks is they tend to work better in these corner case, they smoothly take context into consideration when they make decisions. Whereas, humans, when we write code, we try to boil down this situation we're imagining that we're writing the rules for into a couple of chunks and then write some simple rules according to that. And the thing that we miss is, the weird road systems or, and you don't discover, you go out and you drive those things and you're like, oh yeah, there are ramps that are 35 mile an hour ramps. They're between a 55 mile an hour road and a 65 mile an hour road. And it makes no sense, but that's what the ramp is labeled at, right? And so humans, you just ignore that. No human slows down to the ramp speed. It's not posted there. It's just a characteristic of the way the road system is built. Mm. I mean, you know, you drive that at 60 miles an hour because that's what makes sense, and it's dead straight, and you have perfect visibility. There's not a tree within, you know, 100 yards of you, and you can see all the traffic. There's no reason for you to slow down on that, even though, you know, technically it's a ramp according to some set of rules.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it brings up the question is, do you think, like, there'll be a moment when, like, because a lot of people think that, oh, there's some type of moment where FSD is so good, they switch this, you know, send out this update, and it's so good, you know, that all of a sudden Tesla cars jump in value, yeah, appreciate in value, like, by crazy amounts, and you can drive yourself everywhere. Yeah. Or, I mean, do you see that? Or do you see more of like a gradual approach where there isn't this noticeable time where it's like a switch is, you know, switched on, where it's like robotaxi is just maybe incrementally rolled out with like certain easier areas, and then more and more where it's like this, you know, the boiling a frog, you know, it's just so just yeah, natural, you know, where before you know it, after a few years, you know, it just takes time. Mm-hmm. And then you see maybe the value of the car FSD just increase, you know, accordingly during that time. Like, or do you, are you, like, where are you in that spectrum, I guess?
How fast it looks might depend on where you look at it from time, right? In the middle of it might not look that fast, but in hindsight, it might look quick. It's a smartphones, right? Like, in a sense, it feels like we've had them forever, but like there weren't the modern, you know, iPhone style screen smartphone. You know, the first one came out in 2000, and it took a while for them to get ramping, and now they're everywhere. And so, like, you know, if you view it from 10 years or 20 years in the future, you look back in time, it seems like it happened pretty quick, mm-hmm, you know, because, you know, it's the whole S-curve thing. You remember the really steep part in the middle of the S-curve. You don't remember the front and the end, you know, even though they're part of the S-curve. You kind of, like, don't remember them. They don't stand out in your memory because they're not rapid, mm-hmm, rate of change. I mean, it'll roll out like that. There will be an S-curve. And, you know, we're in the part that's slowly kind of going up now. You know, there will be a point when the adoption rate is significantly faster than it is right now, for sure, at some point in the future. And maybe that ramp, you know, the 20 to 80 ramp, maybe that occurs over 3-5 years or something like that. That could happen. That would be really fast.
Yeah.
I think Elon, it's a great visual, but, you know, he had that line about, you know, there will be an update and your cars will all wake up. And he's not really doing us any favors there, right? Because it was like, it's more like, you know, there will be 100 updates and your car will very slowly open its eyes. I think that's just a more realistic way of, you know, that's what it's going to feel like in the middle, because we're going to be in the middle of the cars opening their eyes. And, you know, and it's going to feel like it's taken a while. And when we look back on it 10 years from now, it'll look like it happened in a pretty short window, because the implications are so large, right? I mean, look at, like, you know, Twitter, right? Twitter didn't instantly happen. It took a while. Facebook didn't instantly happen, right? Yeah. But there was kind of a day when, you know, wow, the world changed because Twitter or Facebook or, and you can come up with lots of other, you know, examples like that where, you know, something had been happening for a really long time, but then there's an event that brings it into the consciousness of the public at large, like, wow, the world is different today. Yeah. And there are going to be, because the change of self-driving cars is so large, there are going to be many opportunities for, you know, for like, oh, wow, blind people can get around, or, oh, wow, I don't have to drive my kids to the soccer anymore. You know, we just call the robotaxi, or, you know, oh, wow, remember that thing? There used to be drunk driving. It used to be a thing, you know, and like, it's totally gone. You know, someday people will just like, yeah, that's not a thing anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's a great analogy with the 100 updates waking up. So Todd on Twitter says, will James ever feel comfortable letting FSD drive him around while he's in the backseat sleeping, or would he never leave the front seat and have access to the controls?
I get motion sickness actually pretty badly. So
in the backseat.
I'll never be sleeping in the car. I can read a book in a car as a passenger if I'm on a dead straight road. But I had made this joke a while back to my spouse about how the like FSD actually wasn't going to be useful for me because, like, you know, I can't even read a book in a car without getting sick. So it's like I never get to sleep or whatever. But I'm super excited about the technology.
Yeah. Do you think you can watch something?
I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. There hadn't been a lot of generally, like, if there's any twists to the road, it doesn't work for me. But anyway, would I do it from a safety standpoint? Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. I used to love skiing in the wintertime, and I lived in LA, and I always wanted to ski in places that were far away from LA. Yeah. And, you know, the idea of being able to, like, you know, you get in your car the night before your ski trip and you just like crash in the backseat and you wake up at the ski resort when you get there and like you don't have to book the first night and you don't have to deal with like the driving in the roads and all. Like it's like it but like I said, that probably won't work for me because of windy mountain roads and all that kind of stuff. But the idea, that sounds so cool.
Yeah. And it seems like it would be incremental also, like the safer places. Like you wouldn't, you know, go to Yosemite sleeping in the back right away. You know what I'm saying? Like you want it proven out on, you know.
A better question is like, would I foolishly check my email while like, yeah, I'd be right there.
Sure. Daniel Gardner says, would love explain like I'm five expounding on the alpha build Elon says he drives. Is this just one iteration in front of beta, or is there an alpha version 11 that has been around for a while that is tweaked often but only driven internally?
Yeah, so alpha, beta, they're pretty soft terms in the software industry in generally. And I think alpha is just, you know, when Elon's using that term, he's using the developers are using it version of the code. As I mentioned before, that, you know, you try something new, you got 10 people that use it, then you got 100, then you got 1,000 or whatnot, and you have like these stages as you go through. And of course, the first people to drive something are frequently the developers. They have a new feature or whatnot. And so you have something that like only people on the autopilot team are driving, like people who know the system really well. They know exactly what changed between the last build and this build, so they know exactly where they need to pay close attention because it could mess up. And I think that's what Elon means. Like he's got the developer build that has all the bells and whistles and is just totally on the bleeding edge. And he's driving that and he's comfortable doing it.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And then so I'm guessing some of those features make it to the next release. Some of them don't. They need to get tested more.
Yeah, probably most of them don't, I would imagine. I mean, you know, the whole throw things at the wall and then you go with what sticks kind of, you know, most of it doesn't stick. It's not so much that you don't have a feature. Like, you know, you could imagine when Andre talked for some point about the cut-ins, right? And how they, you know, how do we get the car to predict when somebody's about to cut in front of you? Because that's something humans in traffic do. And it's important to be able to do it because the other people around you expect you to be able to do it. And if you can't do it, you cause confusion and, you know, too much abrupt braking and whatnot. I suspect that they probably tried 3 or 4 or 5 different ways to do cut-ins, and then they found the one that they wanted to go with, and they went with it. And you could imagine that the developer build, at any point in time, it might have had different versions of the cut-in detector on it that they were out playing around with to just sort of... I had mentioned before, you know, you write these heuristics, you know, you have your neural network and it works in certain spaces. And then there are other things that you write with just heuristic code and you have to bolt it all together with more heuristic code. And, you know, it's got all these, you know, heuristic code has bugs. It has places where it just flat out fails. It just does exactly the opposite. You know, you got the sign wrong or you forgot the equals or there's no semicolon. And you have a huge bug and a very, very narrow, specific kind of behavior. Developer builds are going to have those. And
makes sense. Go Longer, Go Home says, I would want to hear more about what it takes for Tesla to retrain FSD on new markets, FSD Canada rollout, for example. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what goes, like, when they roll out to Canada, I mean, Canada and US are probably, you know, more on the similar side. I'm guessing they're probably different stuff too, but what does Tesla do to roll that out? Do they
Most of the Tesla versus the US versus Canada thing is probably different regulatory regimes. And that, you know, they essentially the things they had to do to satisfy regulators before Canadian regulators would let them push it out to cars was different than in the United States. And, you know, I mean, they apparently Canada is making them block off parts of the country where you can't use FSD. Right. So that's, as far to the best of my knowledge, like no U.S. jurisdiction has required anything like that. And so Canadian regulators looked closely enough at it and wanted enough detail on it that they were able to identify how it performed in different places. And apparently in downtown Ontario, because, you know, I guess what Elon said was it doesn't handle the trains very well, train tracks and that kind of stuff, regulators decided that just you can't use it there. And that was, so they had to put in the geofencing to be able to turn off that thing as a regulatory requirement for being able to release in Canada. But that also indicates that Canadian regulators were looking really closely at a fine-grained map. So that's probably most of it. The question, like, what do you have to do to move to a different market? So Tesla's core approach to doing this is to trying to make it as general as possible. So I would say this is kind of like a language model. Language models these days, you get a really big language model, you train it up so that it has a good understanding of the target language, and then you fine tune it for different kinds of applications. And the fine tuning is a lot less, you might have some additional training data that you put in and you adjust some parameters and not other parameters. You might have another layer that you add to the end and you train that layer to reinterpret what the main model does in light of the context that you, for your specific problem. So I would sort of expect that that adapting to jurisdictions for the most part, like if you're talking about moving between like the US and Germany, right? It's mostly going to be that sort of thing. If you end up in a really different place, like India, right, where the rules of the road are just radically different than they are in the United States, in that case, you might be looking at, yeah, we're going to just collect all fresh data. And we're going to stick with the same model. Perception is basically going to be the same. But we're just going to assume, you know, you aren't in Kansas anymore. We're going to do all the data from scratch. So they're, you know, there could well be places where they really have to like collect all the data from scratch, and then they have to work all out all the corner cases, and it takes a while to get it working. Canada, Brazil, Italy, but
would that be different neural nets then? Like, let's say for India, possibly?
Probably not different in the sense that like big chunks of the core structure have to change, but different in the sense where, you know, they change the size of certain modules in order to accommodate, you know, the relative importance of different kinds of context or features or whatnot, like that, I could imagine. Yeah.
I already probably know the answer to the question, but someone was asking, do you think Tesla FSD will ever work in India? Like, robotaxi?
Yeah, it'll totally work.
Yeah.
In the same way, as I mentioned with the Chess or the Go, like, there is going to be a point in time when it seems really stupid that we let people drive cars because people are so bad at it and the cars are so good at it. And right now it's just hard to imagine. We're like the pre-Wright brothers era, right?
Yeah.
Where, you know, flying machines had been so hard for so long that they existed for years before most people actually, I mean, people had to physically see them with their eyes because they thought the newspapers were making stuff up and that the photos that they saw in magazines were staged. You know, it's really hard to, you know, as global, to get into the social unconscious that, yeah, this thing that you've been told forever is impossible, or it's, you know, 100 years away. Oh, really? It exists. Like, self-driving cars are just going to be like that.
Yeah.
They'll be here for a while before people really believe they're here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I was thinking about Wright brothers. I was thinking, you know, I think FSD or self-driving cars are such a more difficult problem than I think probably the first or the airplane. Like, you could have a small team, you know, work on it. But it just seems like the magnitude of the problem with full self-driving is, it's more of a brain problem, you know, than, you know, mechanical.
Well, the Wright brothers, like, if you're going to take that analogy farther forward, the Wright brothers moment in self-driving cars is a long time ago. I mean, you know, George Hotz did a Wright brothers moment when he took his Acura and he demonstrated that you could get it to drive itself, right? You can, that's been done a bunch of times in a bunch of different places. This is, you know, what Tesla's doing is more like the, you know, the early stages of like Boeing scaling up to passenger planes to carry lots of people sort of thing. Or, you know, it's more like entering the jet era and commercial travel than it is like, you know, the Kitty Hawk moment when we knew, because we've known it was possible for a long time. The Kitty Hawk moment for self-driving cars was a long time ago.
Yeah.
You know, it, You know, the Kitty Hawk was a glider. Even after they put a motor on it, you couldn't go very far in it, right? You couldn't, like, fly across the ocean. It took, you know, 25 years of development to really get to where it was commercializable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It just seems like, it seems like with full self-driving, the complexities of the problem, it hasn't been solved in terms of, it's not that the car can't drive itself. It's a safety issue at a certain point of how many kind of corner cases and situations it can handle safely. And that, it's like, I think I'm empathetic or sympathetic in terms of Elon's missed timelines in a sense where it's understandable because it's
a really hard problem.
Yeah, it's a really hard problem.
And social expectations are different now too. You know, biplanes fell out of the sky 20 years after the Wrights flew and people died and it was sort of understood, well, flying is dangerous, right? Today, like imagine if before we had allowed, you know, airplanes to be used, you had to have the flight safety record of modern airplanes, right? Mm-hmm. It would have made developing them harder. Because you know, it's really hard to develop to get up to scale if you can't be flying stuff around. But they still, you know, they lost airplanes. They'd just go missing in the middle of the ocean, or you'd have a bad storm and an airliner would go down. I mean, we had a long period of time. And today we're kind of not willing to tolerate that. We really want the commercial airliner safety record, like for the first product that comes out the door. And that's what companies are working towards. Yeah. So it's a bit of an obstacle and it'll change our perception of progress because, you know, if we rolled cars out there and rich people could buy them, but the safety was lower than it was for human-driven vehicles, like that would be totally unacceptable today, right? But, you know, in a sense, commercial aviation, you know, you could take a boat, you could still ride in a car and it'd be safer from getting there, you know? I mean, the plane was faster, but it was so much less safe. And today, you know, we want the safety in addition to the convenience.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. So Hi on Twitter says, how does Tesla leadership retain talent, handle retention, trade secrets with increasing market competition and players? Is that a risk where, you know, some of the top talent from Tesla AI team gets poached and, you know, the competitors, you know, emulate, start their own programs, et cetera?
It's changing a little bit, but companies are still in the poacher side rather than the poachee side for the most part, because they're still trying to, you know, it hasn't entirely become a zero-sum game, I think. They're still stealing from academia, right? There are tiers of the data science human resources thing that have been in zero sum for more than 10 years at this point. And certainly, you know, since 2015 or something, it has been a pretty intense zero sum sort of fight to get talent. So yeah, I think it's a really big problem. People make insane amount, like the salaries are like, you wouldn't even believe them. They're like pro football player salary type and signing bonuses, and companies work hard to try to lock people down. But probably more important than that is offering people dream jobs in terms of the stuff they get to work on and the opportunity to grow and the opportunity to make a difference in the world. Like those are all really important components too. I think it's been hard to get people to jump ship once they get embedded. Stock options are a powerful retention device. They're super. People go work at places that are working on problems that are important to them, and some other place popping up suddenly and being even more important in the problem that you're working on. Like, you know, if you went to Tesla because you wanted to make a difference in the self-driving car business, right? And you felt like their approach was the right thing. You know, those people, they don't really have a good place to jump ship to. There may be a couple of places they could go, but Tesla's probably still the best place for that kind of stuff. On the other hand, people who, you know, if you're at Cruise and you really think Cruise is doing it the right way and that's the way to be successful, like Tesla probably can't poach you, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to offer enough money to pull people off, I think, at this point.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, Elon is pushing humanoid robots because...
Mm. Yeah.
It's such a lure. It's like enticing for, isn't you it? Know,
yeah.
Like the best AI talent, because that seems to be one of the holy grails or the ultimate projects, you know, for AI to see a humanoid robot. And people have been, you know, dreaming of that. And so it just seems like, you know, if FSD, you know, as it gets better and better, and as people might, and as other companies might try to poach Tesla's best talent, Elon has this other card where he's like, oh, but we're working on something that's way more important, you know, than even FSD.
It's an interesting question. Like, you know, I mean, every decision has many components that go into it. And I'm sure that having a lure for people who want to work on really interesting problems is a component of why, you know, they trotted out TeslaBot on AI Day, which, you know, they were very upfront about it being a recruiting event. I mean, it is a super big business. Tesla is uniquely well-placed to do that. It could be that advances, you know, I was pessimistic that we would see companies get into it. And I've said, you know, it's a much harder problem than the car. There are a lot of overlaps, and a lot of what they learn doing FSD does, you know, is transportable over to this. That said, you're not just going to copy the code. You know, I mean, it's it's not a matter of taking FSD code and retraining it for robots. There's a huge amount of stuff that you have to solve, or that you have to solve to a different degree and in a different way in a robot. At the end of the day, the code that goes in the robot and the code that goes in the car, they're not going to have a lot in common. Like when they're both like ready to go commercial, the learning is totally fungible. Like a huge amount of it goes across. And certainly the team, the core expertise, all that kind of stuff is really fungible.
Were you surprised when Elon said that there might be limited production of the Tesla bot next year? I think it was in an interview with that German publication or something.
Yeah.
I think he was saying something about volume production, but it was a little confusing. It seems early to me. I mean,
to have something that's really general, I think it, but, you know, if you're looking at the robot, you know, you might look at that and say, you know what, we're going to have to produce in decent volume, like five generations before we've got something that can like fold laundry, you know, to do. I picked that out because it's simple sounding task. It's actually really complicated. And it also implies it's working in people's houses.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, the first generation being something which is much more restricted in its range of capabilities and, you know, its power and flexibility, the environments it can work in, and putting that to work in a factory, you know, and Tesla wants to do automation. And I'm sure they have ideas for tasks that, you know, if you had a humanoid robot that you could build at scale, it could have this narrow operational domain and this more limited set of perceptions and whatnot. And they would be getting experience with building the robots, running them in the real world, manufacturing technologies, optimizing the motors, you know, like, sure. So if volume is, we're going to build 1,000 of them to put in our factory, we're going to build 10,000 of them to work on our assembly lines, and maybe we'll give them to a couple of other companies. Sure.
Yeah.
Like in a year, they could build something that's useful in that space and build a decent number of them.
I mean, what do you think the use case is? I mean, in production, would just be moving stuff, or do you think they'll actually be able to assemble something, or like... Yeah, what type of expectations would you have?
Stuff that doesn't take a lot of dexterity and doesn't require complicated skills, complicated spatial skills, and doesn't require you to operate in a lot of different environments, right? Mm-hmm. Those would be the places you would want to stake. So yeah, you know, moving stuff isn't, you know, that's a obvious stacking boxes and moving, you know, parts distribution inside a factory. I've been fascinated to see the way that Tesla is building their car factories, where, you know, they do this thing where you've got a truck that has, they basically back a truck up to a port next to the assembly line. And that truck is just loaded with the parts and materials you need at that point on the assembly line. So you've got a bunch of truck bays and you swap them out. So you're moving material around the inside of the factory is really moving it outside. You have storage maybe offsite or in a different part of the building, and you pre-sort it, put it in these trucks, move it over there. Okay. So that means there's a lot of like pulling stuff out of that trailer that's parked next, you know, that that's attached to the side of the building and taking it to the right place on the line. Because they're doing this with a lot of different parts in a lot of categories, you could imagine deploying 1,000 robots, where each robot's job is to basically go find a particular category of thing, take it to a particular point on the line, you know, and keep that flowing just as the line goes. It's a kind of like using ants as a logistical system where, you know, like each ant isn't very sophisticated, but collectively, because each one can do an independent job, you can get a lot of stuff done with a herd of ants, even though each one is pretty simple.
Yeah, it's like, what's that picture? All the ants carrying a little bit of crumb, like breadcrumbs, right? To the anthill or something. Yeah. All these humanoid robots taking a couple pieces or some pieces.
So like that would be a place to start, like moving materials around inside the factory. But there are, you know, simple assembly jobs, packing things, you know, you could imagine. Yeah. And this is a, I think the iRobot company, like they, people were like, small businesses would buy their things because, you know, you have a small production line and you make widgets and they're not at huge volume or whatnot. But at the end of the line, you have to pack or sort or whatever these things. So robots that are fairly flexible can take things coming off of the off of an assembly line and then configure them to fit into packing material or whatnot to pack them for, you know, put them on a pallet to go someplace else. It's a kind of gross, pretty straightforward, not super high speed sort of object manipulation in the real world.
When do you think, at what generation do you think Tesla might release it as something to consumers? Do you think they'll do the first couple generations more internally? When they release it to consumers, will it be a limited type of, you know, release? Or like what, because there seems to be some like con in releasing it to consumers too early, because in a couple of years, they'll be outdated completely, you know, it seems like, or the technology is, will be moving so fast early on that I don't know if you want that many consumers, you know, to have that many of them early on. What's your take on
that? I haven't spent a lot of time thinking. It seems like the tree of possible ways they could go is pretty varied. And there, you know, there will be opportunities like do they have partner companies that are also interested in the materials handling thing where, but the materials handling space is independent enough to be interesting, or maybe there's enough demand that it's actually a profitable business and they realize early on, hey, you know, we have this simple materials handling robot, but it turns out that there's a market for 20 million of these things, right? And so we can get more experience, gather more data, you know, scale our factory production. So flip side, maybe those opportunities don't appear. Then there's a trade-off, like what do, when you get, you know, with FSD, when they started developing it, there were things it was good at and things that it wasn't good at. And it's, you know, it's almost certain that starting out, it wasn't, you know, there were things they didn't think of that it wasn't good at. And there were things that they didn't expect that it was actually really good at. And so you adapt to, you adapt your plan going forward based on what your strengths and weaknesses are and what the opportunities are at a particular point. And I think the humanoid robots are going to be rife with those kinds of trade-offs. So even if you know, Elon's got a plan right now, it's probably not the plan that they'll end up following, because he can't know like what the trade-offs will be like once they start building this stuff.
Yeah, makes sense. Twitter, so Elon seems to be bothered by Twitter's censoring, suspending people. He might be, I don't know, starting a new company. What's your take on like?
He's a free speech maximalist, isn't
Yeah. Do you agree with him? Do you think there is?
I am not a free speech maximalist.
Oh, really?
Okay. But I don't know the degree to which people like, you know, of all of the phenomena in the world, the ones where the correct setting is 100% or 0%, those are all very uncommon. Almost everything, you know, like, I mean, there are limits on free speech in the United States. I think they seem appropriate. You know, the enforcement mechanism is probably more of a problem than the ideals that we have in that space. I was one of the people who answered his Twitter poll and said, yeah, I think Twitter, you know, tries really hard to follow free speech principles. I don't know that. My sense is it's actually really hard to do well. And that the trade-offs are so much like FSD. FSD often seems like it's screwing up really simple things. Yeah. And, you know, to a human, like, how can you not see that speed line? It clearly says it's 35 here. Why am I driving, you know, 55 instead of 35? I think, you know, social media companies have a lot of problems like that. So they can be trying really hard and be diligent about doing stuff. And we can still see failures that seem just completely unconscionable, like almost as if they're intentional. And we can read malice in those things when it's just, you know, inability to deal with it. You know, I do tend to, you know, intentionally bias myself towards people are good and they're trying to do the right thing. And that's not always true. So, you know, Elon's a libertarian maximalist. He's super into crypto. He's, you know, he has a lot of positions that I think are interesting. But they're Elon positions, right? Yeah. They're not really part of my world, so I don't have a lot to say about them.
I think the past couple of years has opened my eyes a bit more to the censoring, which I didn't think was a problem a few years ago as much, but when like the big tech platforms started to censor information they didn't like in terms of like there is this narrative, right, that everyone needs to get vaccinated. This is the only way out of the pandemic. And it's like completely safe for everyone, you know, to do it. There's no reason not to. And anyone objecting or presenting some doubts, like you're working against your enemy to the greater goal. And that narrative spread from the government to pharma to medical scene into also, I think, the tech platforms like YouTube and Google, et cetera, Twitter. And they kind of all work together in, I wouldn't say complete, I mean, it's debatable like how much it was orchestrated, but they held similar type of values or approaches to this issue. And I think during that time we saw, you know, Twitter and YouTube kind of, I think Twitter wasn't as extreme in the beginning as some others, but they started to like, if you complained about, it worked together with the masses, the mobs, like they would like have thousands of people report like a video or something, right? And YouTubers would get blasted by all this stuff. And they would say, this is like false, you know, medical information or something. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and YouTube's like, okay. And it matches their view of what's going on in terms of, you know, we can't have this. And so they would pull stuff. But then it got to this point where they started, in the beginning it was more obvious stuff, but it got to this point where it's like a little bit more questionable stuff they started to pull. And in the past, you know, maybe 6 to 8 months or something, they started to pull like, there's a Dr. Robert Malone, who was kind of like one of the mRNA pioneers. And I was following his Twitter account for quite a while. He had, you know, he was a little bit pushy at times and he could say some sensational stuff, but generally speaking, he was trying to give a different view that wasn't, I don't think, completely out there or dangerous per se. He was responding to some other extreme views and Twitter completely banned him, you know? Mm. And then there's been several other cases like that. And I think recently with Elon getting involved, it's like Babylon Bee, they got banned or suspended.
I saw your tweet about that.
Yeah. So they had the satirical piece and then Twitter saying, you have to delete it or else we're going to not lift your suspension. Uh-huh. And they're refusing to delete it. And now this is a big thing.
I mean, right? Satire is tough.
Right? Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, you're intentionally saying the opposite of what you mean. And you're intentionally saying the opposite of what you mean.
Yeah.
And you're expecting people to pick it up in the nuance, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, machines are hard at getting sarcasm. Like, that's going to be tough. And humans are really hard at getting sarcasm. Yeah, I mean, you're pumping this out to a global audience where people who have you know, a lot of Martin native speakers, yeah. or they're seeing it through some filter of their, you know, cultural background or whatnot. So, you know, I think it's a complicated problem. Getting it right is really hard. And, you know, just like FSD is, you know, it's going to have regressions when they push out a new feature, you know. As the social media companies go through this process, they're going to have regressions where, like, they go too far, they go, you know. And their feedback is, you know, what are our regulators telling us? What is the government saying? What is our audience doing? You know, they have this and they're trying to understand it and get it. And I don't want to totally defend them. I mean, could you do better? I think you could do better.
Yeah.
Right. I think it's a really hard problem. And a lot of things that they do that, you know, externally seem like obvious and trivial mistakes are actually, they're complicated because when you're viewing it from the outside, you're unaware of a lot of the factors that have to go into the decision, a lot of the constraints that they have to operate underneath. So, you know, these things are hard. You know, having a thriving you know, having Twitter essentially develop a monopoly on Twitter-like content, and for there not to be competing platforms so that you can have radically different experiments with the right way to do this.
Yeah.
Right. I think that is a shame that we don't have those. I mean, the network effect of these kinds of things means that you tend to have they're very winner take all these markets once they start to get to scale. And, you know, I mean, social media platforms in the world, for the most part, they have to differentiate themselves by changing the structure of their interaction with their users. Because if you have two pretty much identical systems, one of them is going to end up with all the users and the other one is just going to wither after 5 or 10 years or something like that. Okay. So that makes it hard to do experiments, you know, to have the variety of experiments with, like, what's the right trade-off between free speech and, you know, I mean, you know, during the pandemic, there were lots of people who were saying reasonable things who were getting banned, but there was also an unbelievable amount of just flat out BS that, was super, it had these super annoying sort of negative consequences. Like in my, you know, friends and acquaintances, there are lots of people who they're not sophisticated enough to separate that, you know, things that to me are obviously false.
Yeah.
And they're just obviously false. Like, this person is claiming knowledge and expertise and they're making statements that are just flat out false. And so, like, do we have an obligation or should these systems be doing something to try to protect people from that kind of content, labeling it somehow, filtering it somehow? I don't think the answer is no, there should be no restrictions. I don't think that's the right balance. Now, where the right balance is, I think that's tough. And I think it varies with the content. It's a dynamic. One of the things about the social media cycle is it's so fast, right? Things change so fast. And we keep encountering these new phenomena that seem to not fit the categories of things that have happened before.
Yeah.
And the Ukraine thing has been fascinating to watch. Like, more than any other sort of world event, I feel like a really large fraction of the best information that I get and the most understanding that I get. I mean, you know, social media, it's full of all kinds of misinformation and it's full of all kinds of disinformation. And certainly the Ukraine situation is not, you know, but things evolve so quickly. And there are so many people with expertise that is relevant and valuable and which can be traded off against other people that if you put your time into it, social media is a super valuable way to try to develop an understanding of what is going on. And I think that has a ton of utility. Yeah. And I can't think of any other phenomenon in history, in recent history, where social media played that role in the way that it does. I mean, COVID vaccines were a thing. And they had a lot of their own problems, but it was very different to me than this. Yeah. You know, I mean, you don't have, you know, a nation state literally trying, you know, investing in large amounts of resources in trying to, you know, bend the narrative to a particular perspective, you know, which that's just a very interesting information, you know, disinformation environment to try to operate in. Okay. I feel like my disinformation tolerance skills in the last couple of weeks, like I've really taken it up a couple of notches because you have to think so much about what you're digesting. Why am I thinking this and what does it mean?
So, I mean, with Ukraine, so some social media platforms they have removed like Russian sponsored TV RT, channels and all that stuff. Do you agree with that? Or what's your take on that?
Yeah, you know, I wasn't looking at the content, so I can't have an opinion about it based on the content. Not having seen the content, it feels wrong to me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm definitely biased toward, you know, allowing information to be out there. Yeah. You know, I think that's the right bias to have, right? Yeah. But I don't think that means there should be no restrictions at all. You know, I would draw the line far on the side of being permissive with respect to content, but I would not draw it all the way to 100%.
Yeah, like my preference or leaning would be like let the information out and let people disagree, especially on, you know, things that have a level of like unknownness, like you're not sure of the outcome or the conclusion, and let history, like let time, you know, kind of work itself out and all of that is just evidence of that you'll need. That gives evidence of what people's past positions, what they've said, if they've come true or not, and if their, you know, arguments have changed.
We could have much better tools for evaluating the credibility of sources. I think one way that social media could get a lot better is to give us, as consumers of social media, more tools to better evaluate. Like, you know, if you see an opinion or see something, like, how many people share this opinion? Like, how common is it? Is this like a friend? Is this a friend? Where is this guy on the spectrum of opinion? Like, is this guy really an expert? Is this source who they claim to be, right? Like, how, you know, I think there are lots of things they could do, but even if you provide people with all those tools, you're asking people to put the effort into like consuming the extra content, having context and that kind of stuff. And, you know, the reality is in society, there is all kinds of stuff that we just, you know, society decided a long time ago that they're just going to filter out and we don't get access to. And mostly we don't complain about it because we're not, you know, the argument for human cannibalism, like, how often do we hear that, right?
Yeah.
There are all kinds of things that just seem absurd and they're fringe and they're just deleted as irrelevant. And we're not super upset about those things. But the flip side, you know, going back to COVID as an example, I mean, we have a little history on this. Like, what's the right, so you've got this pandemic going on, right? And at some point in the pandemic, you think, well, you know, the best way out of this is if we achieve a level of, you know, herd immunity via vaccination, which we believe to be safe, you know, safer, you know, so there's this consensus, you can believe it or not, that that vaccines are safer than actually getting COVID, that, you know, if we can get to a high enough threshold, you know, I mean, vaccines are, you know, if you're going to stop an infection from spreading, you have to get to a certain threshold of the population crossing, you know, accepting the vaccine. And then you get efficacy and it dies out because you got the R number down below one, right? And, you know, public policy was, we're going to get there, right? Like, that's how we've solved big disease issues in the past. It's proven to be effective. We got super lucky with these vaccines. They seem super efficacious against this thing. We got to get it out there. So they start pushing it. And public authorities, health authorities, they look at the stuff and they're just like, these things aren't getting penetration. And oh my God, there's this huge backlash, right? So they double down. These people are lying to you, right? Yeah. They try to push to see if they can get over the threshold. And of course, the resistance builds. They never get remotely close to the threshold that they need to achieve the goal that they had to. And both sides just, it becomes totally polarized and strident. And, you know, so that's a big fail. This is a response to your thing about, well, let's just take some time and see what happens. Well, in the middle of the pandemic, we're thinking, man, so many people could die if we don't get this right. Like worldwide, so many people could die. What's the right trade-off there? It's hard for me to look at that and say, oh, they made the wrong trade-off for sure. Because if you knew what they knew at that point in time, they seemed like they had the solution in hand. They needed the public to buy into it. And, you know, and they had this category of information available to the public that seemed to be, the jury's out on whether it really was a huge impact on people accepting the stuff or not, but it seemed to be a major contributor to that. So pushing back on that, was that the right thing or not to do? Answer that question in the context of like millions of lives are at stake and we have to do it now.
Yeah.
Because 3 months from now, 6 months from now is too late. I'm sympathetic to people struggling with that. Yeah. I think it's a hard problem.
I mean, I get that, but my issue with the whole kind of past couple of years is you can try to convince and persuade people without suppressing information. You see what I'm saying? Like you let the information out and you make a case, right, for something without trying to pull out and label and, you know, scapegoat or slash blame people who have different perspectives. Like, for example, early on, you know, with the pandemic and vaccines, there are, you know, virologists and people I was following saying, hey, this is a coronavirus. Typically, like if you look at coronaviruses, they mutate pretty fast. Like for example, with existing common cold type of viruses, like it hasn't been worth to do a virus, even though we could have done it because this thing, you know, the symptoms weren't severe. People aren't dying as much with just a common cold, but also it mutates enough where it's like you have a vaccine and then you have to get another vaccine. And typically if there is something that's really severe, it, you know, over time as it spreads out, you know, the most likely scenario is the symptoms to decrease over time. And there are people who are saying, hey, herd immunity with vaccines, it's not going to be possible. This is going to mutate before that. And I'm not saying that's the right point of view. I'm just saying those objecting point of views shouldn't necessarily be like canceled out of these social media platforms, mm-hmm. right? But the thing is, these social media platforms, they become almost the de facto place of information, like YouTube and Google search and Twitter, where I think as they become like monopolies on information, they need to probably adhere closer to legal, like they do this trump card where they say, we're a private company. We don't have to adhere to free speech, right? Because we could do whatever we want. But there is, I think, some responsibility as they have more and more of a monopoly on information that they should actually adhere closer to free speech, you know, principles rather than pull the trump card, we're a private company, we can do anything we want. But I think that's where it's like, I'm okay with, you know, people saying, hey, we need to do this, X, Y, and Z, let's get on board, whatever. But I'm not okay when they start to, you know, attack and try to silence, you know, objectors, because then we don't, I can't make a clear decision, you know, anymore. But yeah, it's been concerning because like even with certain search engines and stuff, it's like, I don't think I'm getting objective information on certain controversial topics anymore. I think it's bent a certain way. And I know that because I compare different search engines with certain controversial topics and they come out so different and so politicized in a way. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like, and I wouldn't be so like, I guess, concerned if it wasn't like, if there were 10 different search engines and 10 different YouTube type of things you can get different perspectives from. But when it's such, you know, winner takes all network effect dynamics on our information, that is like, I don't know, it just seems to be consequential in terms of, you know, whether we censor or not, whether, you know, we like the approach. So I don't know.
It's hard.
Yeah, it's hard. The world
is changing fast. It's a consequential thing. We want to try to get it right.
Yeah.
We're not learning fast enough to like not make huge mistakes.
Yeah.
And so we keep making huge mistakes and hopefully we learn from them and things get better.
Yeah, that's the hope. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's been fun. How has this in-person interview been different than...
you know, I'm surprised. It's more different than I thought it was going to be.
Actually, same here. There's like much... there's more intake of like, you know, like body expressions and... Yeah, it's interesting.
I really noticed the lack of time lag. Like the time lag isn't so large. I feel like we spend a lot less time talking over each other because like I'm getting your speech cues more quickly. Which is nice for flow, and I'm sure it makes for a much better viewing experience
too. Yeah, it's actually a better just personal experience because it's fascinating stuff. Awesome, James. I think our 2 hours is pretty much up here at the studio. We've actually rented the studio in Austin to test it out. So yeah, thank the studio as well. I think that's about it. Yeah, I think.
Well, thanks for inviting me. This is an interesting experience and an interesting experiment.
Yeah, yeah. Anyways, yeah, hope to see you again at GigaFest. I think that's it. Thanks. And thanks, everyone.